As I mentioned last week, we'll be starting the fifth chapter this morning. And what we have found in the book of Timothy is that it's a very practical book, a book about how men ought to conduct themselves in the house of God and how preachers and evangelists should conduct themselves. And so this morning we're going to be continuing that theme with the way that a congregation is to deal with benevolent situations, specifically with widows. That's pretty much what the first 15 verses of the chapter is dealing with, is the benevolent needs and when to say no and when to say yes. Because obviously, compassionate people in the church are going to want to give money to who? Anybody that needs it, right?
Yeah.
And so you're going to find people who are going to say, we need to help this person. Well, and if the church doesn't help somebody, what do we think?
They're not compassionate.
Yeah, they're not compassionate, or they're not loving, or they're not generous. But one of the things we have to understand is that there's the Lord's money and there's our money, right? And that the Lord's money is kind of like when I'm working for a business. If a business gives me a credit card to conduct business, then what do I use that credit card for? Yeah, and is that my money?
No,
and I can't use it for what I think should be used for. I have to talk to the employer and whatever he wants it used for. And if somebody says, you know, this person needs some money and you've got the credit card from your business, what do I have to tell them?
Can't help. So.
You know, if I use that, I'm breaking the law. I'm not a good person. And so the church finds itself sometimes in the same situation. As we've noted in the past, we can't take the church's funds to help people who are not members of the church. There's just no authority whatsoever for the church. The church was not a benevolent institution for the world. It's only a benevolent institution for brethren. And so there's going to be widows that people are going to say, you need to take care of them. But Paul says, no, you can't take care of them. What do we do then? Well, we take whatever rocks people want to throw, because we're not a benevolent, compassionate people, but that's what we're going to see as this lesson proceeds. Okay, so we want to start with a personal comment to Timothy, which I'm not sure is just exclusively for evangelists. I think we all need to take this advice. There's always a temptation when somebody does something totally inappropriate. Our response, or at least a lot of impatient people's response, is to take them aside and rebuke them, or to be harsh with them, because they ought to know better. And that's this word rebuke here in verse 5, chapter 5, verse 1, do not rebuke. It's a term that means, it's a literal term for striking or beating someone. And then in words, can you beat someone up with words? Can you cause someone to feel just absolutely beaten down with words? And is there a temptation sometimes to do that with people? And, of course, if we're in the middle of an argument or if we're upset with somebody, the temptation is there to use our abilities to really cause that person to understand how bad they've done. But we are commanded not to go too far. Matter of fact, he says, do not rebuke. He says that we should not beat people up with words. And this is always a temptation. I remember when I was first converted and we'd get into discussions with denominational people that sometimes you wanted to win so badly. And have you ever seen debates where the guy just goes after the person instead of staying with the doctrine and just pounds on them for if they make one mistake, then that becomes the issue. And you can win a debate that way, but are you going to convert people that way? And so, I get disappointed sometimes when preachers do that, when they make it a personal attack instead of just staying with the preaching and the teaching. So, Paul tells Timothy, do not rebuke an older man, but exhort him as a father, the younger men as brothers, the older women as mothers, the younger as sisters. So in a family unit, And again, I guess it depends on the makeup of the family. I mean, if people have high tempers, I guess you can have this kind of stuff even in a family. But generally speaking, if a son sees his father do something inappropriate, how does he approach him?
As a father.
Okay, as a father, which means what?
Respect.
Respect. You want to point out that he's done something wrong, but you choose your words carefully. And you choose your words in such a way as to continue to manifest that mutual respect. And God wants us to do that in our relationships in the church. So do not chide, do not beat up with words an older man, but exhort him. Now, we are first introduced to that word exhort when in Acts chapter 2, Peter testified and exhorted with many other words. What's the difference between preaching, testifying, and exhorting? Remember, Barnabas was a son of exhortation. He could exhort. Not everyone can exhort. Rob?
Encourage.
Okay, encourage. Anybody else? Jeannie?
You exhort someone, you call them to your side, you put your arm around them, you try to help them be better.
Okay, so you are emotionally, this is an emotional discussion. It isn't just a facts discussion. George? Oh, no, I'm sorry. Ray?
Yeah, my translation says entreat.
Okay, entreat. So entreat, and that's an interesting thing about this word. It can be translated beseech. It can be translated entreat, and it can actually be translated admonish. But it's a special kind of admonishment. It's an admonishment where you're trying to make somebody want to do what you're telling them, and try to motivate them and move them with emotion and with a desire. I guess with love. And you see this with Jesus and his apostles. Do you ever see him chiding them? I mean, that last night, they said some things that, you know, with the pressure Jesus was under and some of the things they said, could you see him lashing out or being irritated or just... But he never does that. The closest he comes is, of course, when he tells Peter, "Get behind me, Satan." But he's not chiding him. He is simply identifying what he's doing. So... Did I see a hand? I thought I saw a hand.
I was just going to say encourage through consolation.
Okay, encourage through consolation. So where's anger fit into this?
Does it?
Yeah. You ever notice when you were parenting young children that when you were angry it was always easier to discipline than when you weren't angry? No? You didn't notice that? Okay, I did. It was always easier when you were frustrated with somebody to confront them than it is just to confront them out of love. Confronting out of love requires that we push ourselves to do something in the best interest, whereas if we're angry, why are we doing it? To fulfill a desire that we have. Brian?
Yeah, and Jeannie mentioned the emotional aspect. And as you know, emotions can be good or bad. And so you could be passionate, you could be frustrated, you could be angry. Those are all very different emotions, and so we talk about counting to 10 and so forth. You know, a lot of times when you want to speak to someone, you really need to put some thought into that. If you're just rash or you do it on a whim without putting a little thought into it, it can turn into the wrong kind of emotion,
right,
and go south in a hurry. You know.
And what did James say about the wrath of man?
It's not the righteousness of
okay.
God.
When you're angry, I had an older preacher once tell me that anger is temporary insanity. And you're not thinking clearly. And whatever you do when you're angry, you're going to regret it later. Unless you stop, like you said, and count to 10 and rationally think through. And so I've just learned through the years, whenever I'm irritated, I just don't say anything to people because I'm afraid I'll say the wrong thing. Of course, sometimes that means the next day when you're not angry anymore, makes it a whole lot harder to want to say anything, doesn't it? And you just kind of say, I think I'll just let it go. And we're going to talk about that in the lesson this morning, because if it doesn't rise to the level of church discipline, there's a lot of things that people do that you can't move it into the realm of church discipline. You can't really put it in Matthew chapter 18. So it's a personal decision whether to confront them or talk to them about it or not, or whether to allow them to grow out of it. And that's always something that it's always difficult with new converts, because there's so many things wrong. Can you hit them on everything at once? No. So what do you have to do?
Give them time.
Give them time. Well, that happens too with older people. Sometimes we see things that people have trouble with, and we tolerate, we are compassionate, and we try to help them grow through it. But as I say, sometimes you decide to say something, sometimes you just let it go, because you know they know. Remember when John says, if you see a person sinning, a sin not unto death. Well, which sin can you commit that's not unto death?
None.
So what kind of sin is this? It's a sin you know that what are they going to do? They're going to repent, because every sin leads to death. And so if I see somebody do something and I know that they're a good person, a godly person, I know they shouldn't be doing it, do I need to confront them? If I see them sinning a sin not unto death? No, I'll just pray for them. Let's face it. As we get to know each other, could we be chomping on each other all the time? Yeah, because as I'm going to talk about this morning and talked about last week, you know, sometimes you can't see your weaknesses, and you think other people can't see them, but can we see them?
We see them more clearly than you do.
Yeah, sometimes I can see, and it's kind of funny. I've often told people that when you first come into a congregation, you're really blind because you don't know the people yet. But after 3 or 4 years, you know where everybody's coming from. You know what their strengths are. You know what their weaknesses are. You know how to deal with them. And this just gets more and more clear as time goes on. And so as that happens, like I said, I'm going to preach on it this morning, so let's not go any further into that. Okay, so the older men, the younger men, the older women, the younger women. And if you notice, it's father, brothers, mothers, and sisters. And as I mentioned earlier, I don't think this should be exclusively seen as something that only evangelists need to do. I think that verse 1 and 2 is actually the way that God would like for all of us to deal with the confrontations that we're going to have. If your brother sins and you go show him his fault, then what do you do if he's an older man? You exhort him as a father. If it's a younger woman, you exhort them as a sister. And then he throws in that with all purity, which we'll get to in a minute. Rob?
We can definitely take things out of context. You know, Paul isn't telling Timothy this here, and then when he gets over to 2 Timothy 4:2, he's saying something totally different. Of course, the word, you know, reprove, rebuke, exhort. But it seems to be there's a specific application he's making of this. This doesn't mean, you know, we can't turn to this and say we are never to rebuke anybody, because look right here what Paul is saying. I think the situation and the person and all things considered has to be factored in when you're talking to anybody. There is sometimes when we do need to rebuke somebody. It just depends on the situation. And as I said, maybe this is definitely because of maybe somebody to an older person needs to, at a minimum, respect them, that they go about this whole thing in the right way.
Right. Well, here's another situation, kind of like love. There's two different Greek words for rebuke, and this one is not something that we're supposed to do. Can you rebuke someone in exhortation? I mean, can you rebuke them in love? You've committed this act, it's a sin, you're going to have to deal with it. But you're not beating them up, you're not chiding them, you're simply talking to them and telling them, this has to be dealt with. You've done something wrong, and you have to fix it. Is that rebuking? Yeah, it's rebuking. I mean, it's accomplishing what rebuking accomplishes. You don't have to be ugly and rude and obnoxious, you just have to point out, this is wrong. And so... Virgil, I see your hand.
Well, I don't know of any time when being ugly and rude is right. That's always wrong. I think that in the context here, it pretty well qualifies the older man. Respect the older man. The youth need to respect the older.
Right.
And so in this setting, told about the rebuke, but rather appeal to him as a father. How would you approach your dad on these things?
Right.
You're not going to take him and beat up on him, or you're going to take and try to reason with him.
And I think that's really the gist of this, is what we're saying.
Right. Yeah, and depending on the circumstances, I mean, in the 1 Corinthians letter, is Paul pretty strong with that fornicator? Sure. But is he beating him up with words? Is he chiding him? No, he's just calling black and black, calling white white. He's just there's no gray here. This is sin. You can't deal with this. You've got to remove this person. And he rebukes them. If I were present, I'd have already dealt with this. And you're puffed up and you're not mourning. But he's just reasoning with them. He's not chiding them. He's not beating them up with words. So you can rebuke someone. Rebuke just simply means bringing them up short. It means telling somebody, you have to stop doing that. Now, I can tell my father, you have to stop doing that. Or I can just, you know, you're so stupid. Don't you understand that it's idiotic to act the way you're acting and you've got to quit doing it because you're... Is there a difference? I think we can all see the difference. Rob, did you have your hand up again? Oh, okay. All right, so the older men, yes, we respect them as fathers, but does it mean we don't have to worry about the younger men? No, you exhort your younger men like you would a brother. You exhort your older women as you would mothers, and you exhort the younger women as sisters. Now, the with all purity is an important consideration for younger women because... whenever a man is in the presence of a woman, things have to be very careful. We take thought for things honorable in the sight of all men. Generally speaking, if a man is wise, he will not go to a woman alone, a younger woman alone, but he'll bring his wife or he'll bring somebody with him so that nothing can be misunderstood, so nothing can be misconstrued. And so with all purity simply means that we need to be certain that no matter who examines this and no matter how closely they examine it, there's no charge that can be made. There's nothing that can be brought up. George?
It seems to me that expression applies to fathers, elders, brethren, and mothers also. All of the ones he's mentioning, it seems like that's just how he's summing it up, that all of them should be treated with all purity.
Well, there would be some truth to that, obviously, but that wouldn't change the fact that when you're dealing with younger sisters and purity, that you need to be very careful.
I'm disagreeing with that. I'm just saying I thought it applied to all those situations.
Okay. All right, then we come to verse 3, and we have to deal with the word honor. In English, honor has a little bit different connotation than it does. When God says, honor your father and your mother, that it may go well with you, what's he talking about there?
Respect and maintain.
Okay, respect, submission. But when they get older, what does it mean?
Maintain.
Okay. Remember when Jesus rebuked the Pharisees, he said, you have told people whatever you might have been profited has been given to God. And he said, you're teaching them not to honor their mother and father. So what's he referring to there? That which you might have been profited has been offered to God as Corban, or it's a vow. I've made a vow to God. And now, after this vow has been made, you're coming to me and telling me that you need financial assistance, but I've already offered it to God. And what do the Pharisees tell somebody like that? Just keep your vow to God. What does Jesus say?
Honor your father and mother.
Yeah, honor your father and mother is more important. So, excuse me?
You have to do both.
Okay, you have to do both. Virgil?
Yeah, I basically say it's a matter of priority that I look at. If your mother and your father are hurting and they cannot take care of themselves, you have a responsibility towards them for what you have now becomes part of theirs.
Right. And let's say, for example, that we're giving absolutely all of our extra income. And if we have to give our parents money, we would have to take away money from the Lord that we're giving to the Lord. Is there any difference between giving to your parents and giving to the Lord? No, it's virtually the same thing because God asks you. Are both sacrifices?
No.
Yeah. Are they both for God? In submission to God? Yeah. So this is actually something that the Pharisees, obviously, what were they looking at? Yeah, they wanted money. It was just the bottom line. But again, the point in verse 3 is that when it says honor widows who are really widows, he's not just talking about treating them with respect. He's using this term in the same way that the scriptures use it in Matthew 15. So, but notice really widows. Just because a woman doesn't have a husband, is she really a widow? Well, not under this context. Not in this context. The honor, the church that is giving honor to widows can only give honor to widows who are what?
Widows indeed.
Widows indeed is the Old King James translation, or really widows is the newer translation. So, well, what do you mean, Paul? What's the difference between a widow who is really a widow and that the church should honor, and a widow who is not a widow? Well, he gives it in the next verse. Go ahead, Virgil.
Yeah, the next verse I was going to say.
Oh, sorry. I hate it when I steal somebody's thunder. So, Virgil's right. It means given in the next verse. Okay. If a widow has children or grandchildren, then should the church honor that widow? No. No. If any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show piety at home, and to repay their parents, for this is good and acceptable before God. So let's say you have a well-to-do family, and the husband dies, and the family is expecting the church to take care of that woman, the funds of the church. The church takes care of widows. So, but what do we have to tell them? We can't do that. If a widow has children or grandchildren, then let them first show piety at home and repay. What does repay mean?
They raised you.
Okay, they made many sacrifices when you were young, and now you need to make many sacrifices now that they're old. And to expect the church to take care of it all, that's not what God created the church for. The church is not primarily, is the church a benevolent institution or is the church an evangelistic institution?
Evangelist.
Yeah, clearly the main role of the church is to be involved in evangelism. And the secondary role is edification, which means taking those evangelized people and bringing them to the Lord, ready to spend eternity with them. The benevolent activities are a part of the work of the church, but they're not, they're a lot more closely regulated, I guess I'd say. Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every preacher. Any regulation there? Any regulations on evangelism in the church? No. No, there's no regulations. Anytime a church has an opportunity and they can fulfill that opportunity, then they should take advantage of it, and there's really very few limitations. But when it comes to benevolent activities, the church's hands have been severely, well, I won't use the word severely, they've been limited. The church has been limited on what it can do. So if a widow is to be honored, the first criteria is she has to really be a widow. And so then we have to say, okay, well, let's read the whole context and see what a real widow is. So what does the word if mean? When I say if...
Conditional.
It's a condition. It's a condition that has to be met in order for her to really be a widow. But in this case, can she be a widow? If she has children or grandchildren, can she be this real widow? No. No. They need to first learn to show piety at home. Now, what happens if these people are not members of the church and they won't help? So the widow is starving. What should the church do?
Help her.
Okay, it's a tough one, isn't it? Because it says honor those who are really widows, but if they have children or grandchildren, but those children and grandchildren will not do. Now, if they're members of the church, then of course you would go through the church discipline process, right? They say, we're not going to help them. Well, you need to go show them their fault. If they won't hear, then what do you need to do? It needs to be dealt with. Now, if they say, well, we can't do it, and you go talk to them and you find out, well, they really can't do it. But, you know, it all depends on the level. Yeah, most people can't afford to keep their mother in their own home with all their own expenses. And but can they bring them into their own home and feed them and take care of them there? So there's ways around this. Did I see him? Okay. So if a widow has children or grandchildren, then the preacher, the elders, the church is to tell them, you must first learn to show piety at home. In other words, this is a part of your responsibility as a child or a grandchild. In our culture, how many grandchildren think it's their responsibility to take care of their grandparents? See, that's kind of gone the way of the wind. And part of it is the culture. With Social Security and all the social network that we have, most widows, do they need their grandchildren and children to take care of them? No. So this particular section is really kind of not emphasized very much because it doesn't happen very often. George?
Well, there's plenty of scriptures that show us that we as individual Christians should be willing to help those that the church cannot help because we're supposed to do good unto all people.
Right.
And we tend to think of our giving as what we put in the contribution plate on Sunday morning or Sunday night, and that's not what the scriptures tell us. There's a lot more giving we as Christians have to do.
Right. That's true. But it's harder today because of all this. Somebody's house burns down, and you're ready to go in there and help them. What do they say?
I got
all kinds of insurance. I could use a little bit of help to get through, but I can pay you back when I get, because I'm going to get it all back. Same thing with a serious health problem. You might take them food or something, but are they going to need financial assistance if they have good insurance or if they have Medicare? So, you know, there's things you can do, but as I say, our culture has really minimized what brethren, the sacrifices that brethren might have made in previous generations that become a little more difficult now. So that when I'm driving I get off on the freeway and here's a guy with a sign saying, I need help, what's my skepticism say to me? You know, I don't know what to do with this guy. I mean, he may be legitimate, but we read stories all the time, people who are abusing that. So, again, it's just we have to be as wise as serpents, as harmless as dove. But George is right. I mean, we need to be involved in that. It's just more complicated in our culture. Virgil?
I think this is dealing with a mother and a father is a two-edged sword on this thing. One is physical aspect of supplying shelter, food, things there like that. Another is the camaraderie that it should take place within a family. That widow has to be considered as part of that family and to work with her so that she feels comfortable. She's at home. She's not a ward of the state in a sense. She's not a beggar. And we've kind of lost this in our society, like you've already mentioned. We have these other catch basins that we have set up around here. And a lot of times, just because the widow has a Social Security check coming in, she sits in an apartment over here, and the family doesn't pay any attention to her.
Right.
That's wrong. That is in violation to the principles that we're looking at right now.
Yeah, that's part of the honor.
That's it.
Part of the honor of your mother and father. And part of paying them back. As you say, emotional needs are just as critical as physical needs. So, George?
Well, to add to what Virgil said, we also need to be smart enough to realize when we cannot truly care for our parents that as far as physically, supposing, for instance, that they have to be helped in and out of bed, their medications monitored all the time, et cetera, sometimes it's much better if we can make it happen, in particular, if they are in an assisted living place, because they will be well taken care of, and we will kill ourselves, so to speak, if we try to take care of them, especially maybe if we have a bad back or whatever.
Right. Yeah, and that's always a gut-wrenching decision, isn't it? You know, which way should I go here? And, of course, we don't respect at all the person who just says, I don't want them in my home, so I'm going to put them in a, you know, assisted living. On the other hand, the person who wants them in their home but just physically can't do it anymore. And so motive has everything, right? I mean, motivation and your reasons behind it. But okay, let's get back to our focus here, though. Our focus is that the church has responsibilities and individual family members have responsibilities. And so the woman who has parent, children or grandchildren is not a widow indeed. And the church, the evangelists, let's go back to chapter 3 again. I'm writing this so men ought to know how they should what?
Conduct
themselves in the house of God, which is the church of the living God. So a widow who has children or grandchildren, that is not a real widow. Now in verse 5, she who is really a widow, left alone, trusts in God, continues in supplications and prayers night and day. But she who lives in pleasure is dead while she lives. So verse 6 disqualifies someone from being a real widow. Verse 5 are the qualifications for a woman to be a real widow. If she doesn't trust in God, is she a real widow? No, not according to this verse. If she doesn't continue in supplications and prayers night and day, she's not a real widow. If she lives in pleasures, she's not a real widow. And verse, so a real widow is a member of the church, right? A real widow is a Christian. A real widow is a devout Christian. A real widow is a godly Christian who trusts in God and continues in supplications. But the widow who lives in pleasure is dead while she lives. So her character is also a part. Just because a woman loses her husband, just because a woman has no husband and has no income, is she a real widow? Not according to this verse. And if she's not a real widow, Paul's very clear that we should honor real widows. What about women who are not real widows? Let their family take care of them. Or you have to say, the church can't do this. Now, if we have some concerns, can we do it individually?
Sure.
Yeah. If we're, and we do this a lot. Somebody comes into the building and they tell us their hard luck story, and it turns out to be a real hard luck story. Do we get Jeff to write him a check out of the treasury? No. No, the men here just say, we're going to do this on an individual basis. Like George was saying, we have a responsibility to do that. But we can't, just as I said earlier, you can't misappropriate funds in your business, and you can't misappropriate the Lord's funds either. If the Lord has said you should use your money for this, then we should use our money for that. If the Lord has said, I don't want you using your money for this, what do we do? See, our hands are tied. I mean, I don't know how she'd deal with this. If she's not really a widow, then Paul says you can only honor real widows. And she's not a real widow if she has children or grandchildren. And she's not a real widow if she's not left alone. She's not a real widow if she doesn't trust God. And she's not a real widow if she continues in supplications. And she's not a real widow if she gives herself to pleasure. And then verse 7, these things command that they may be blameless. What's he telling them to command? That the church shouldn't take care of widows who aren't widows, or that the widows shouldn't give themselves the pleasure? Well, I suspect both. I mean, these things isn't just verse, if it was just verse 6, he wouldn't say these things, would he? He'd say this. He would say, this command and teach that they may be blameless. No, I think that the whole process here, I think he's to command the family members that they're supposed to take care of their parents so that the church, so that they can be blameless. I think that the church can only take care of widows who are really widows so that they can be blameless. So this passage is a limitation. And again, we don't have this very often today because, as I say, there's not a lot of real widows because of life insurance and Social Security and other things. They're not really desolate. Richard?
Yeah, this word supplication. Could you elaborate? What were some of the meanings of that word?
Well, remember back in chapter 2, I desire that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings be made to all men. Supplication and intercession, supplication simply means I'm generally asking for things. Intercession means I'm asking in behalf of you. So if I'm interceding for, like I've been interceding for Johnny ever since we found out about the surgery coming. So we're praying that God will be with the doctors and God will be with him. That's intercession. A supplication would be, Father, forgive me, I'm a sinner, or Lord, please be with the lost and help the church to do its responsibility, and just general prayers. So supplications is a more specific element of prayers, but it's much more general than, say, intercession or thanksgiving. Now, I have to be thanking to be thanksgiving. I have to be interceding on behalf of somebody else to intercede. But prayers and supplications are almost synonymous. There's just a small difference between them. Okay. Virgil?
The New American Standard uses these terms, to me, is a little bit easier to understand. And continues in it, entreaties and prayers night and day. Entreaties is like you say the intercession, and then prayers night and day would be supplications.
Okay. All right. Does that help, Richard?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
In verse 8, if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So when it comes to taking care, what is... Now, the older King James Version and has own house, but it really is just his own. So his own what?
Family.
Well, his own family. How about his wife's family? Yeah. So this takes in all of the individuals that he has a relationship with. Then especially, what's the difference between his own and his own household? Carl?
Mine says relatives.
Okay.
Relatives and those of his own household.
Okay. So, Rob?
I was just going to answer your question.
Oh, go ahead.
That it would, I would think his own household would be just your immediate family, but then those, like you're saying, you could extend to your wife's family. It, I don't know. It could be quite a bit of people that you have might have responsibility for.
Well, and that's right. And our country would be a whole lot better if people would take responsibility for those things instead of expecting the government to do it. Laura?
Would that include people that you live in your house that aren't related to you? That you know, let's say you have a friend and they're staying at your home, or maybe a foster care or something like that. I mean, it would include anyone that's living in your house at that time, or is that?
Yeah, I'm trying to. You know something? I didn't print that page out. Sorry. So I'm not sure. Don't remember what the Greek word is, so I can't really answer with any knowledge. I'd just be guessing here. So let me answer that question next week. Ken?
I was just thinking it might have been referring to the household servants at that time.
Well, when Lydia was baptized, who was baptized with her?
Her
whole household. Cornelius gathered together his whole household So household, again, it can include servants, although I'm not sure if God would expect you to take care of all of your servants the way you do your family. But as I say, let's leave that one go right now. But the critical element here is that we have to provide for our own, or we're what? We've denied the faith. That's a pretty strong charge, isn't it? I mean, this tells us that the family relationship is almost up there with God, right? I mean, what would you have to do to deny the faith? Do you believe Jesus is the Christ, Son of the living God? If you deny the faith, what would you say? No. You believe God exists? No. Do you believe the gospel is the power of God and salvation? No. Are you taking care of your mom and dad? Does that seem to fit with you that that's denying the faith? But that's what he says here. It's equal. It's way up at the very top of what God expects of people. Virgil?
An older word that is used in some of the translations, I think King James used it, you're worse than a heretic. And that and that draws attention. What does this mean?
Right. So this is something for us to give careful consideration to. I mean, this isn't something that you just kind of gloss over. If you're not actually providing for your own, and then especially for those of your own household, number one, you've denied the faith. Number two, it's worse than being an unbeliever. Now, how can it be worse than being an unbeliever? It's like that passage in Second Peter where he says that it would be better for them not to know than to know and turn from the commandment. Well, how can it be better?
I think it's because it's the very essence of the gospel, right? Love and compassion and those. If you don't have that, you know, there's problems.
Right. Okay. Carl?
Well, nature itself teaches that one is beholden to his own family. It's like nature itself teaches us sin for a man to have long hair. Nature teaches us a lot of things without this.
Right.
You see?
Mm-hmm.
So, and even though we don't know, we know the scriptures, it'd be better that we didn't know, have known and rebelled.
Right. Ken?
Well, didn't Jesus say that those who do things ignorantly are beaten with few stripes, but those who had more to be responsible for and didn't do it would be beaten with many.
Right. But then we're back to the same thing. How in the world does that work? You know, I mean, I thought that you either went to heaven or you went to hell. How can there be many stripes and few stripes, and how can there be greater rewards for some over others? And we won't go off into that now, but that's an interesting inquiry to ponder. George?
Well, I think that it is a point of emphasis, but also an infidel in many cases will take care of their family. And I think that's the concept, is if you won't take care of your family as a Christian, you're worse than those that don't even believe in God. Just as a point of emphasis, it
right.
seems to me.
Well, I'm sure that's part of it, but when he says denied the faith and worse than an unbeliever, the implication is that you ought to know better. I mean, there's certain things that when you learn and you do them, as Ken pointed out, if you know something and you do it, is that worse than not knowing something and doing it? To God, it is. To God, when you know that you're not supposed to do something, remember what Paul said? He says, I have lived before God in what? That means that while he was persecuting the church, did he know? He didn't know. If he had known, would it have been worse? Yeah, much worse. Matter of fact, Jesus probably wouldn't have appeared to him if he had known. He said, he appeared to me because I did it ignorantly in unbelief. So when you are taught something and then you refuse to accept it, that does make you worse. Now, George would be right. If my next door neighbor is taking care of his family and I'm not, then I'm going to be worse. But even if my next door neighbor is not taking care of his family, am I still worse? Yeah, because I know better. I know better. And knowing, remember what Jesus told the Pharisees? He said, if you didn't know, there wouldn't have been sin. But you say you know, therefore your sin remains. Did I see another hand? Rob?
Well, real quick, it puts an awesome responsibility on us that are fathers and mothers. And I'm not trying to be cynical, but I do see an irresponsible country. I mean, it just seems like it's getting worse. You hear of fathers that aren't providing for their children. You hear of broken homes and nothing's being done. It's not all like that. I'm not doom and gloom, but we are becoming a nation that's more and more irresponsible. Let the government do it. No, we're to take care of our own. We're not to look to anybody else.
Right.
And it's a serious responsibility. And as you pointed out, if we think, well, it doesn't really matter, well, does having faith matter? Does believing God matter? Does being a Christian matter?
You remember in Romans chapter 1, he uses a term there, without natural affection. And what's he talking about? What's natural affection?
Love.
Well, wanting to take care of your mother and father, wanting to take care of children, wanting to, I mean, there's just some things that, like Carl said, you don't have to be taught. They're just part of nature. Without nature's affection, without natural affection. Well, some people don't have it. Where'd they lose it? Well, they're so selfish that it's not even a part of their consideration. And people like that, they've already got their money allocated. They don't want mom and dad coming in, eating up part of that money they were using for their hobbies and activities. Carl?
I came from a time when it was a shame to take charity. Now people live on welfare and think they deserve it.
Yeah. Yeah, the world's changed. All right, well, go ahead, Johnny. Sorry.
Is hate a natural affection?
I don't know how to answer that, Johnny. Yes, it is. It's we couldn't hate if it weren't part. Can we manufacture emotions that God didn't give us? We were created in the image and likeness of God. Does God hate some things? So hate is a natural affection, but it's a natural affection only in a very tiny realm. And so hate and lust are two things that God gave us, but they have to be carefully managed and carefully utilized. Okay, let's go ahead and stop there. And I'm going to come back to this next week, as I want to answer Laura's question, and also want to spend a little bit more time on it. And then we'll continue on beginning verse 9.